My name is Ed Goldberg, and I have the pleasure of talking to Jill Kelly. Jill, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you, Ed. Glad to be here.
Title of your book is Sober Truths, The Making of an Honest Woman, and it's published by iUniverse. We'll talk a little bit about iUniverse later. But in the interest of full disclosure, I guess I've known you, what, about 10 years now?
Yeah.
Something like that. And you're the sister of a good friend of mine who used to do movie talk with me.
That's right.
Okay. To get right to it, this is a book about how you became an alcoholic and how you put that all behind you.
Yeah, it's a book about how I got there and then how I left there. And it's really in two parts, the what we call the justification, when you, in 12-step, you claim your seat and justify your presence. And then the years, almost 19 years now, since I stopped drinking, and how I completely changed my life, leaving relationships, leaving a career as an academic, becoming a visual artist, becoming a writer, developing a freelance business, how everything in my life changed as a part of letting go of the old life.
Hey, the painting on the cover is beautiful, by the way.
Thank you.
You did that.
I did.
Yeah, it's very nice. There are certain formative experiences that you write about in your life that do you think that they contributed to whatever it was that made you seek to drink all that stuff? Or let's talk about it. Let's talk about St. Cloud. What you actually mentioned that in the book. So what did that do for you? What did that mean for you?
In that experience, my family was living in a kind of an apartment above a garage out in a big estate up the gorge. And we were there temporarily, and I was sequestered with my brother and sister across a road in another house that had no plumbing or no electricity. It was old and was a summer home. And I learned pretty quickly that my mother, there was nothing that could be done about this situation, being separated from my mother for 6 weeks at night. And I developed night terrors, and I developed a lot of anxiety, and really realized that I had to take care of myself, that I began to feel that my parents were either not paying attention or couldn't, for whatever their own reasons were. And so that developed a pattern for me of not sleeping very well, kind of constant anxiety, and also a feeling of just having to do everything all by myself, which is wearing and exhausting.
How old were you at the time?
9.
I have to say that if I were 9 years old and I could live separate from my parents for a whole summer, I think that's the coolest thing in the whole world. So I'm kind of curious as to what, did it manifest itself in your brother and sister as well? Or
my one sister was 6 and she remembers very little of it. My brother thought it was a cool adventure. He was 13 and he loved torturing us with the boogeyman out the window and the snakes under the bed. And,
typical Big Brother stuff.
And I think if it had been summer, it might have been a different experience, but it was the dead of winter in 56, and it was icy and cold, and we had no heat, and we had no plumbing. It was just seemed a strange and weird thing to be 3 kids locked into an old building.
Yeah, I hate to be cold, so I'm right with you on that one. When you said it was a summer house, I thought, oh, it must have been summer.
But, no.
Let's talk a little bit about relationships, because relationships have a lot to do with the kind of person you became. And when did your self-esteem, for want of a better term, when did you stop looking at yourself as a desirable person? And what did that have to do with what eventually happened?
I would say, from what I know now, that having a relationship with myself in which I couldn't depend on anyone else made relationships very difficult for me. I was either overly dependent on someone I'd give everything over, and that's what happened to me with the men in my life. I gave everything over, and in many ways I became as addicted to them as I did to alcohol. They became my reason for being, my and all of this was strange because here I was a fairly smart woman. I was going to college. I eventually went on and got a doctoral degree. But I was in these relationships with men where I wanted them to take care of me. And, of course, nobody really wants to do that for another adult. That's just not how it works. So I either took care of people or I tried to be taken care of myself. And neither one of those makes for a very healthy relationship. I think drinking became for me a way to one, deal with my anxiety. I had no knowledge of pills or any of the other kinds of things people used. And it just became an easy way to be someone I wasn't, more socially adept, easier to flirt, easier to get into relationships, easier to just have a good time and not be so kind of stuck in myself. My experience of alcoholics, and I've certainly known a lot in recovery, is that most of us are introverts who are pretty isolating, pretty solitary folks. And in order to function in the wider, more extroverted world, we drink or do drugs or do something that lets us be less inhibited. And that was certainly true for me. But as I describe in the book, the first couple of times I drank to excess. I was clearly alcoholic right from the get-go, but had no knowledge of that. I assumed that everybody drank to get drunk, mm-hmm. that was the only reason to do it. So that's why I did it. And I went for long periods in my early years not drinking. It didn't become a chronic condition for quite a while. But I clearly had an unusual relationship with alcohol. And the information about alcoholism was not nearly as prevalent as it is today.
There's, the old image, I think, I'm pretty sure this isn't as much of a cliche as it used to be, but of the happy drunk, of somebody, having a few at a party and, loosening up and having a lot of fun and all that kind of stuff. And I guess the difference between somebody like that and somebody becomes alcoholic is that you don't stop when you feel good. You don't stop when you're tipsy. You don't stop when the inhibitions have fallen away. You just keep going. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I think that's a very fair statement. We really think, in 12-step, we really think about the fact that there are three kinds of drinkers. There's the normal drinker who may overindulge from time to time, most often with sorrow. When there's been a loss or a death, that person will often drink a bit too much.
Situational drinker.
Situational drinker, or at a party or at a wedding, whatever. Then there are problem drinkers who, and often male, who just drink too much because it's kind of cool to drink too much. And then there are those of us who can't stop, who don't have any way to shut off. There's nothing comes on that says, I've had too much. Mm-hmm. There's always something that comes on that says, I haven't had enough. And so there's just never enough. No matter how much there is, there's never enough.
So that thing that you hear often associated with 12-step programs is that if somebody falls off the wagon, one drink is too much and 1,000 is not enough. Is that right?
Yeah, that's very much my experience. And it's why we don't fool with it, because we never know what'll happen with one drink.
Now, I've been at parties in the same room with you where I'm pretty sure there was alcohol served. You don't have any problem walking away from alcohol in the same room with you now?
No, I don't. But if I'm going to a function, I go to a few functions where there's alcohol as the main entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
And there are parties like that where people do that. And I always take my own car and I always take something to drink. That's one of the tricks you learn, is you always walk in with a Coke or something in your hand. So no one will offer you a drink then.
Yeah, that's right. Club soda is a really good thing to have in a glass, because people think you're having a drink.
That's right. Or you're just, you don't need anything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And one of the truisms about being in a social situation, you get a little nervous, you need something to do with your hands. If you've given up smoking, then you got two hands, you need something to do. So, you having a bottle of Coca-Cola or something, right, is a good thing to have.
Well, and what happens for many of us, as I talk about in my book, is that we turn to food,
mm-hmm.
because you can eat with two hands.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're at a party and you're not drinking, you're generally eating, and food becomes the kind of substitute. Some people smoke. Some of it's oral, I'm sure, just some kind of oral fixation. But many of us turn to food. Many of us turn to sugar, because alcohol is primarily sugar, and we're still looking for that fix. And there's a lot of thought that diabetics and alcoholics have a lot in common in the way their bodies process sugars.
I wonder if they'll find that the same gene is affected once they get into that genome thing.
It's very possible. It certainly seems to apply to Native Americans who have high rates of both.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about some of your relationships. Tell me how, pick the most important relationship in your life. Tell me how it started. Tell me how it continued, and tell me how it ended.
The most important relationship in my life with a man started at a party at a keg in Eugene, and I was already pretty drunk. And He was a whiskey and scotch collector, and though not an alcoholic, he turned out to be a sex addict. And we were in a relationship for almost 11 years, in which he had other relationships and let me drink, and I drank and let him have those relationships.
So being a sex addict mean he didn't just wear you out. He needed to find other releases.
He had numerous women mm-hmm. all the time, okay. and this was his idea of freedom. In relationship. He wanted an open relationship.
Which, well, this was back in the 70s, was it? Or 80s?
In the 80s. In the 80s, yeah. 70s okay. and 80s, yeah. yeah. And that didn't sit very well with me, but it was, I was into that relationship, and by the time I found out, really figured out what was going on, I was really hooked into the relationship. And I kept thinking he'd change. And of course, and he didn't seem to mind that I drank, and I think a lot of it was that he didn't know how much I drank. We lived separately. And that's very convenient for people with addictions.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say he collected booze.
Yeah.
He was didn't drink it to excess?
He didn't drink it to excess. I saw him drunk only on a couple of occasions over mm-hmm. those years. He was just somebody who drank some and just really liked it. It was a sophisticated thing to do. He liked the taste. And, mm-hmm. But for me, one of the amends I had to make after I got sober was to send him money and tell him that in many of those bottles there was a lot of water mixed in with
instead of that nice single malt 15-year-old scotch.
That's right, yeah. Because I would fill up a Tupperware with
this is like a kid.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, you know what kamikaze is?
Yeah.
Yeah, where a kid will go fill up a jar with a little bit of the booze in every bottle.
And right.
Yes.
Exactly. Well, I never did that, but I would mix. I had my own blend
yes.
that I took home in a Tupperware on days like a Sunday when the liquor stores were closed.
So you're also a smart lady. I mean, I know this from a whole lot of reasons, and you have a PhD, as you mentioned. Mm-hmm. How did this affect your academics? You had responsible jobs, and you had a lot of work to do as a graduate student. Weren't you worried that it was affecting your ability to do your job?
It never seemed to until towards the very end. I was drunk through most of my graduate studies. I didn't start drinking until the afternoons in those days. I didn't drink in the morning. I would work on my PhD and teach my classes. But as the time went on, I was a round-the-clock drinker, and I couldn't go very long without a drink. So I had, I often taught drunk. It's one of the great shames of my life is that I often taught drunk. And I gave an unfortunate number of pop quizzes because I couldn't make it through the hour without something to drink. So I'd give a pop quiz, go back to my office, drink a little bit, and come back and teach again. And I found after I got sober, I went on teaching for another 4 years. But I found being an academic was too easy. It was too easy to be an alcoholic, and I just, it frightened me.
It's a kind of permissive atmosphere as well.
It is, and you have a lot of time of your own. You have an office to yourself, and you have a lot of time on your own. And there's a certain cachet around drinking and writing and mm-hmm. all of those things. It's kind of romance. And there certainly wasn't any romance in my drinking in the last 10 years of it.
I'd like to remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Jill Kelly. The title of her book is Sober Truths, The Making of an Honest Woman, published by iUniverse. I have some experience with heroin addicts, and they tell me that they knew they were hooked when they no longer got high off the drug, but they called it getting straight. They got out of bed in the morning, and they had this craving, mm-hmm. and they just wanted to feel quote-unquote normal, mm-hmm. and they would take a shot. Anything like that with alcoholism? Is that...
Yeah, By about 76, I drank until 89. By 76, I was drinking in the morning because I just couldn't get the queasiness and the shakes to go. So I'd have a hideous combination now of white wine and 7-Up.
Ooh.
And but it gave me enough sugar, and it would give me just enough alcohol to get... It wasn't a buzz I was looking for anymore. I was looking to function. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of... one of the things I realized is that there is kind of a shrinking window of okay with a progressive alcoholic is that window of feeling good gets smaller and smaller and smaller. You either haven't had enough or you've had too much. And the kind of constant nausea and headache and hangover.
That's the thing about your book that most amazed me is that one of the reasons I gave up drinking to excess when I was in my 20s, I guess maybe I was 30 by that time, was that I couldn't stand the hangovers anymore. And when you're 18, 19 years old, you know, you wake up in the morning, you feel like crap until about 11 o'clock, and then it's, you know, you're all right. But the older I got, the worse the hangovers were and the longer they lasted. Didn't you just sit up and say, I can't take this stuff anymore? I'm not going to touch that wine?
I would, and I would go for periods of time without drinking. I'd swear off for 6 months. But what I found is that I smoked a lot of dope.
Is that right?
And that became kind of the alternate. And that wasn't really what I wanted to do. And eventually, I'd always go back. There'd always be a birthday or a party, or I won't drink till Christmas, or I won't drink until 4th of July. And then I'd go back. And then after, there's a number of lines one crosses. And after I crossed the last line, there was just no not doing it. No matter what I said, I just couldn't not do it.
It's almost, I mean, I don't want to put too highfalutin of a thing on this, but it's almost like you were seeking an altered state, that you needed to have that altered state to function.
That may be. It seemed very physical to me at the time. I think what I was looking for was emotional relief. Mm-hmm. I think that's what most alcoholics are looking for. And then the more you drink, the more shame and guilt there is, and the more awful you feel about yourself. And because when I got sober, I had no idea that AA existed. I had no idea about 12-step programs. I had no idea that there were treatment centers. I had no idea of anything. I thought there was no way out except going cold turkey. And every time I went cold turkey, I had my same painful life. And I had no alcohol, no anesthetic. And it wasn't until I got into a treatment center and began to get straight that I could see that if I changed my life, then I could survive without alcohol.
What was the response at the various stages of your life of friends and family? Didn't people say, wow, you know, I've noticed you've been drinking a lot lately. Can anything I can do to help? Did you get any of that?
No.
Really?
No, except for my sister. At the end, about 2 months, she confronted me and did a little mini, what we call intervention. And she just told me she knew how much I was drinking. She knew I'd already been drinking. It was 9:30 in the morning. And that she wanted me to do something about it. It took me another 3 months. And it was only because my brain started to go. I started to be unable to function.
Did you black out?
No. Oh, I had been blacking out for years. Uh-huh. But I began to have this kind of inky sludge in my brain. I couldn't concentrate. I couldn't use words, which were my stock in trade.
Right.
I couldn't really function anymore. And I went to see a doctor and from there went to a treatment center.
I guess when I read this book and it said the end, I said, why? I wonder why Jill would want everybody to know this about her. Is it part of the 12-step program to confess to all of your transgressions, or why write the book? I guess that's the question.
Well, I wrote the book for myself. I wrote the book to make sense of my, for two reasons, to make sense of my past and to let it go. To truly let go of old relationships, old stories, old patterns, old habits. And I also wrote it to become a better writer. It was a clear imperative for me to do that. I just wanted to do that. But when I read these stories to people, they were really moved. And when I showed them to other people in 12-step, they were really moved and inspired by them. And so I got some encouragement to go ahead and publish my story. And I really do feel that my book can make a contribution to people who are not sure whether they have a problem or, more importantly, are in the early stages of sobriety and don't know how to do the long haul.
Do you think that people hold their problems in because they're unable to articulate them? Do you think that a lot of people who are not good with words or don't have much insight into their own character, personality problems, or whatever word you want. I don't want to get too psychobabble here, but do you think that people who are not able to articulate their problems have a harder time dealing with them? Aha, the thoughtful answer.
Yeah, yes, I would say that's probably true unless they have some other outlet.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of people in 12-step become gymaholics, exercise-aholics. That's one way.
Coffee and cigarettes.
Well, or no, or exercise, and one way to deal with things. And what I found is that writing and painting both were really important to me, and that's the other part of getting my work out there in the public, is to show that becoming an artist was a really important part of long-term sobriety for me. It gave me a place to deal with my feelings without drinking about them.
Mm-hmm. And it also keeps you busy.
It does. It does. It keeps all that free time, that endless, what in the world am I going to do with myself now that I'm sober?
Filling up the days becomes a problem.
It did at first.
Yeah,
it did at first, and now it's not a problem. Now my life is really full and busy.
The book is published by iUniverse. Why? Tell us about why you chose iUniverse to publish the book and what goes on with them.
I investigated several publishers, and the response I got to the chapters I sent was that they wanted to make a lot of changes. They wanted to really beef up the sex, and they really wanted a lot less of the... they wanted more of the drunkalogue, the first part of the book, and less of the second part of the book.
They wanted another James Fry book.
Yeah, or they wanted the sensational part of it. And I didn't want to do that, and I had really worked on my book over and over, and I'd had a number of readers and editors, and I thought, you know, this is the way I want it to be. This is my book and the way I want it to be. So I looked into self-publishing, and iUniverse was the best deal. It was the best deal financially, and they do a little online marketing for you. And they turn out a great product.
It's a good-looking book.
Yeah. I do freelance editing, and I'd had a client who'd used iUniverse, and I was very impressed with the quality of the paperback book. And the fact that they'd let me do my own cover and put my art on it, all those things were important to me.
Yeah. I know from dealing with publishers, and you've had your experience with publishers also, I don't want to say all publishers are scum, but I'm kind of in... You know, I tend to think that way. And one of the things that... once they buy your book... Your creative control of what goes into even things like covers becomes very limited.
Yes.
And, most people are so thrilled to get published that they will just say, hey, you're publishing my book. You want to put a picture of a dead horse on the cover? That's okay with me, you know? And they kind of abdicate their own responsibility to themselves. So I'm glad you're able to find those.
Well, and I also found that... publishers today, one, aren't doing any editing or very little editing of books, which is why
bad editing.
Or what we're finding, or just spell check. Mm-hmm. And that they also aren't doing very much marketing, that the author is really needs to do the marketing too, most of it. And I thought, well, if I'm going to do that, then I might just as well. Putting my book out through iUniverse cost me about $500.
Mm-hmm.
It was really feasible for me to do that and to have, and I wanted my book completed.
Yeah, I understand. Do they publish an online version as well as a hard copy version?
Yes, there's an ebook version as well.
Okay. Where can you buy this in town if people want to get the book?
Online. You buy it
you
online.
Buy it online from,
or buy it from me.
iUniverse.com?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It's on Amazon. It's on Barnes & Noble. It's on pals.com as well.
Oh, okay. That's good. What was the effect of this book on your friends and family? Did you tell secrets in this book that none of them had ever known until they read it in the book?
I think, yes. It's not so much secrets as I think no one had any idea how bad it was for me
mm-hmm.
and how miserable I was because I was a great pretender. And I had already learned as a child to put on a happy face and to function well. And I think they were kind of appalled at all of the misery that I went through. It was also easier to publish this book after both of my parents had passed away.
Mm-hmm.
There are things about my relationship with them that I think they would not want others to know. So I felt comfortable. The timing all worked out for me to publish it after they had both died.
I mean, in the amount of time I've known you, I know you was a tough, smart lady, and I was kind of stunned by some of the stuff I read in the book also.
Mm-hmm.
Her? She wouldn't do this. But you did, didn't you?
I did.
Yeah,
I did.
Yeah. When was your what was I thinking moment? When did it finally occur to you that your life was going down the crapper and you're saying to yourself, what am I doing to myself? Was there a moment like that, or was it a gradual... reassessment of your life?
I was conscious of the fact that I'd become an alcoholic about 2 years before I got sober. I just didn't know what to do about it. So I kept trying all these things, and we talk about it in the big book. We talk about how you start drinking only beer, or you don't have a drink until after five, or you never mix drinks, or you only drink on the weekend. We try all these things, but none of them work.
You're bargaining with your condition, in effect.
That's right. And it was a moment of grace when the doctor came in and said, how much do you drink? And some voice spoke through me and said, told her how much I drank. And she said, are you ready to stop? And I had not even contemplated that stop for good. And I had not even contemplated that. And then once that happened, then there was the big shift. But the real psychic shift for me didn't come for several years. It took me years to get the fog out of my brain and to get back into life as life is lived, instead of living the kind of life where all I worried about was how much I had and did I have enough and was anybody going to know.
Mm-hmm. 12-step programs are work very, very well for a lot of people, whether it's Narcotics Anonymous or Alcoholics Anonymous or, you know, Gamblers Anonymous, whatever it is. But there's always the thing that a lot of people have about turning your life over to a higher power. And a lot of people I know are agnostic to atheist, and that bugs them. Did you have a problem with that?
I had a problem more with the sexist language in the literature. I didn't have any trouble seeing that people who came to the meetings stayed sober, and that the meetings and the group of the other alcoholics could be the higher power, that you could, in a sense, you didn't have to see them as God in any way, but you could see that the collective could do something that the individual could not. Mm-hmm. And that allayed all my fears, because I was agnostic when I went. I've since become Buddhist, though I'm a Buddhist who believes in God. But I didn't, that took a long time too, but I didn't have trouble seeing that the group, clearly people who went to the meetings, there was a woman that I met in the first week who had been sober for 2 years, and I found that astounding. Mm-hmm. That she, because I couldn't go more than 4 hours, and she had gone 2 years without a drink. And then I began to meet people who had been sober for 20 years and 30 years, and I could see that they all came to the meetings. And I could see that if I did that, I wouldn't have to drink again.
Do your relationships with the people in your meetings extend outside the group, or is it truly anonymous outside the group? I know you probably have a sponsor.
I do have a sponsor, and I sponsor people myself. Yeah. Some people have become good friends of mine, and some people live completely, their whole world and community and social life and family is the 12-step program. Mm-hmm. That has not been true for me. I regularly go to meetings, and I see people, and I talk to people, but I have a whole wide variety of other friends and family and that I see. That just varies from person to person. Many people are quite antisocial, and being in the group is really safe for them.
Yeah. I guess feeling safe is a big part of it, because your anxieties, your social anxieties, and your interpersonal anxieties are the things that started this in the first place.
Yeah, and that becomes better as you go along and you learn. And in fact, there's a whole wonderful social life that occurs in 12-step programs, dances, parties, all kinds of things. People have a great deal of fun with no alcohol.
Yeah, you don't have to drink and smoke to have a good time.
That's right.
Jill, it's been a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you, Ed.
With Jill Kelly. The title of her book is Sober Truths, The Making of an Honest Woman. You can get it at iUniverse.com. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks, Ed.